Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, Salt Lake County, like Salt Lake City before it, gets pushback on the proposed locations for a new homeless resource center. Jason Chaffetz and Mike Lee look to overturn a decision requiring additional pollution controls at Utah power plants. Imprisoned St. George businessman Jeremy Johnson gets a night off from his 11-year prison sentence and calls for Governor Gary Herbert to veto a measure lowering the blood alcohol level for DUIs, among other stories. Joining me in the studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod, glad you're here as well. Thanks for being here.
Hi, good morning.
Government reporter Matt Piper, here on his day off. Welcome and thanks for coming in, Matt.
Glad to be here.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke is here as well. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can join the conversation as well during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Post your questions and comments at sltrib.com or call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Matt Piper, we talked about this last week a little bit during our legislative wrap-up. Salt Lake County is now on the hook for one of the new homeless resource centers and is responsible for figuring out the location of the new shelter site. The selection process isn't going exactly smoothly, I guess. It feels a little bit like deja vu. First off, where are we in this process right now in terms of candidate locations being identified and what happens next?
So late last week, we got five site finalists from the county, and then this week already we've had an open house up at the Capitol where residents from South Salt Lake and West Valley City, which happen to be where all of these shelter sites are located, gave the mayor, most of them an earful. They gave to the mayor. A few of them, I think, were supportive. The stage we're at now is Mayor McAdams has continued to say that he is open to other sites, but the county has apparently purchased an option for each of these sites, these five sites, and the public process continues with, I'm sure, more reasons not to put a shelter in these five locations to come.
Okay, and so this is West Valley City, South Salt Lake. All of these are west side of the valley locations. From the get-go, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams said this was going to be an open process. He said he was seeking public feedback. I know we've heard from officials from West Valley City and from South Salt Lake, but what are residents in these neighborhoods saying?
Well, the fact that they're all west of Main Street is something that comes up. But more specifically, at South Salt Lake, they say that they're the county's second smallest city. They have already a population that includes a lot of refugees. They have, I think, something like 30% of their properties are tax exempt because they already house quite a few regional services. And they say we just don't have the tax base to make this happen. Our fire and law enforcement are already stretched so thin that if we were to have a 200-bed homeless shelter here, we'd need to hire, 12 to 15 additional officers and all the other things that come with it. And without a bill that was passed by Representative Ellison that Representative Ellison was unable to get passed, even through the committee that he chairs in the last session, there's really nothing coming back to municipalities that get the burden of this shelter. And then in West Valley, it's a similar but not totally equal argument. West Valley says the number one problem with homelessness is housing. Mm-hmm. We provide the county's largest share of affordable housing, something in the neighborhood of, I think, 33,000 affordable housing units. Apologies if I've got that wrong to West Valley City, but it's just another. They view it as they've stepped up before, and this is just another burden for them. Mostly, it seems on their proximity to Salt Lake City and the related services there.
Okay, so South Salt Lake saying, look, we've got jail facilities, juvenile justice center, permanent supportive housing. West Valley City saying we're doing our part by having affordable housing units. Nobody seems to want this. I mean, this is, I guess, to be expected to a certain extent. There's a deadline for making a decision on where this will go, right?
Yeah, so the county has until March 30th to present this recommendation to the state's Homeless Coordinating Committee, which will have the ultimate say. The county, I think, deliberates a couple days before that in what I think is a public meeting, but the public won't be able to give input anymore at that point. There are three open houses, so there are two more still to come. And there is also another meeting of this county site selection committee that will take public input as well.
Okay. Robert Gerke, I want to bring your opinion columnist perspective in on this. The mayor has gotten some criticism for not having, the mayor of Salt Lake City, Jackie Biskupski, mm-hmm. had some criticism for not having a more open process during the site selection. I got some criticism. I should say that you actually gave some of that criticism in your own column.
I helped, yeah.
But the county is trying to do it differently, but under this very tight time frame, are they succeeding at being more open?
Well, the tight time frames are sort of a function of the legislature wanting to see some progress on this as soon as possible. And so the time frames kind of are what they are. I think the process of having these open houses and actually going out and listening to people is a good one, but you're still, it's not surprising that people are not happy about having these in their neighborhoods. And I think that there's a perception, particularly among the residents of South Salt Lake and West Valley City, that they're already pulling their weight when it comes to providing for the jails and the other county functions that they already have in their neighborhoods. And then B, there's sort of this east side west side divide that's sort of been perpetuated in Salt Lake for as long as I've lived here. And so now you've moved this one from Simpson, that's around 7th East, out into the west side of the valley, and they think that they're getting just dumped on again. So, I think there's going to be a significant hurdle to overcome there, and it is interesting that all five of the proposed sites are west of Main Street, certainly. So yeah, it's they're going to have their work cut out for them, and people are still going to have a bitter taste in their mouth no matter how it ends up. Excuse me.
Sure. No, you also wrote about something that is related to the Simpson Avenue site that you mentioned this past week. You said that Mayor Ben McAdams, or at least we've found out now that Mayor Ben McAdams owns three homes within a half mile of the now abandoned Simpson Avenue shelter site in Sugar House. Did that play into that site's being withdrawn from consideration on the city side?
Probably not. The evidence that I've seen is that it looks like it didn't. There were lots of problems with the Simpson site, including the high cost, the $7 million price tag, and then the uranium tailings cleanup that was likely to have to come as a result of that, or would likely to have added that to that price tag. But he did have these three homes there, and the questions that I raised were, did he disclose these the way he should have? And it looks like he didn't. He says he put them on his financial disclosure that he's required to file with the county. That disclosure, the only way you can find that is if you go down to the county offices and ask them for a hard copy of it. And even if once you get it, he just lists these two holding companies. He doesn't list the addresses of the properties that are owned by those holding companies. Yeah. And so there's really not a whole lot of transparency there. And so, again, when you have people, in West Valley and South Salt Lake who are like, now they're looking down the barrel of having a shelter in their neighborhood, and you've got Ben McAdams who's putting it there, who suggested that that's one of the best sites for it, and you have a shelter that was proposed in his neighborhood that got torpedoed, it's certainly, it's one of those things that just makes it that much harder for people to swallow because it hadn't been disclosed the way it probably should have.
Well, you mentioned the other factors at play, uranium tailings adding up and things like this may be playing into it. You said in his neighborhood, does he rent these homes or does he live nearby?
Two of them are rentals, and one of them is his personal residence. Okay. The other thing I said in the column is that he could have turned this into a positive and say, "Hey, look, I have flesh in this game. We're all in this together. We got to make it work, and I'm prepared to do that." And by not disclosing it, it actually just came off looking just the opposite of that.
Okay. I remind our listeners that you can join this conversation. 801-355-8255 is the number to call. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Matt Piper, I want to go back to you on this. Is all of the funding in place for these three shelters that are coming online, two in Salt Lake City, one in Salt Lake County, elsewhere than Salt Lake City, is that lined up? Do they have the money for this?
That's a good question. The state's portion of that funding is all lined up. So the state has committed $20 million toward building those three shelters. Between the cost of purchasing these properties and the cost of ultimately building these things, which is yet to be determined, but they have some estimates. I think you're looking in the neighborhood of 40 to 50 million. So they still need to come up with more. They already have, I want to say, about 15 million in private donations. And that leaves, if you do the math in your head, somewhere between 10, 20 million, maybe more to be raised. They're not as worried about that component, though. They think as far as fundraising goes, it's much easier to fundraise for the physical structures. The bigger concern is the ongoing costs of operating these sites, which they figure at about $2.3 million a year per shelter. And that's kind of why you saw, or at least that the explanation has been, that is why you saw the course change midway through the legislative session, where they went from four sites in Salt Lake City to three sites that were slightly larger and one in Salt Lake County. It was because it's simple efficiency and you know, you drop one shelter, you drop, they say, you know, the $2.3 million a year that you need in ongoing money. And they were coming up about that amount short prior to that decision to do that.
Remind us of the expected size of each of these shelters, I mean, in terms of beds.
Yeah, that's sort of a controversial topic right now. I saw sort of a kind of heated exchange at the first open house up at the Capitol and kind of got pulled into it because somebody was saying, well, the media said. So what I've reported is the two Salt Lake City sites are expected to have a capacity of 200 beds each. Then the county site, everyone has said, would be at least 200 beds, maybe more, maybe somewhere in the neighborhood of 300 beds. And you've had County Mayor Ben McAdams, Representative Francis Gibson, who passed the funding bill. Multiple people have said this, but where it becomes contentious is people, residents of these communities say, well, why would we get the largest one? We're going to get the largest one. We're going to get the worst one, because they also assume, based on some comments, that it's going to be the single men's shelter, and obviously is associated with the highest risk population. So the grand total, you're looking at anywhere between 600 and 700 beds. But right now, it is sort of a sticking point, and I think there may be a little bit of conversation happening that we're not aware of about what population Salt Lake County gets and how big it is.
And finally on this, there is a firm close date now for the Road Home Shelter downtown, correct?
Yep. So they have until June 30th, 2019, which is a long way out. And anything can change. You know, they say it's a firm close date, but really this is in the hands of a nonprofit that many of these same people are on the board of. But ultimately, it can't be legislated. But they have committed, and I think some of the language in the funding bill too says, you know, we need to see commitment from all partners toward that close date. And by the time they get through all the processes involved in this and get these things built, there's not going to be a lot of time between the opening of these new shelters and that close date at the Road Home.
Of the Road Home. You know, actually, one final point on this. There was a bill at the legislative session that kind of takes the decision – well, not the decision, but the ability for a municipality to reject the shelter and maybe perhaps the men's shelter, as you said – that whoever loses that musical game or wins that musical game of chairs, that game of musical chairs, I guess is the way I should say it, they don't really have recourse, is that?
They're stuck with it, okay. Yeah. They really can't do anything. I think one thing that you may see is some support for Representative Ellison's bill to be brought up again in the interim, because it would provide up to $900 per bed per year, which goes a long way toward hiring a couple police officers. That may not fill the need, but it certainly gets you closer to what you need.
It's something. Okay, in the name of a new strategy on homelessness, some new actions being taken. Guys, we do need to turn to other stories from this past week, but actually before we do so, let's take a quick break. You are listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour,
we'll celebrate St. Patrick's Day with Celtic music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and beyond. I'm Dan Storper.
And I'm Rosalie Howarth. Join us for Celtic Crossroads, the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Join us Friday night at 10. on Utah Public Radio.
I mean, my marriage was falling apart. My dog had died. My life was a mess. So I bought a plane ticket and an evening dress, and I flew off to Kathmandu, waving goodbye to my husband.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour, True Stories Told Live, from the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Join us Saturday night at 6 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, reporters Matt Piper and Emma Penrod, and columnist Robert Gerke. Listeners, you can join us with your comments and questions at 801-355-TALK or by commenting at sltrib.com. Emma Penrod, to you now, and some environmental stories. Senator Mike Lee and Representative Jason Chaffetz want to curb EPA regulations on Utah's coal-fired power plants. They're proposing a measure to roll back an EPA decision from last year on this. What was that decision, and why do they say that they're trying to? Why are they trying to do this? I guess how are they trying to do this is maybe the question to ask here.
Yeah. So what happened here is this is part of an ongoing decade-long discussion about this regional haze rule within the Clean Air Act. That says that, you know, in national parks, we want to have pristine, clear, natural air. We don't want to have any haze. And then the states were charged with coming up with plans to ensure that that happened, you know, to reduce pollution from whatever sources of pollution there may be in their states near national parks and other wilderness areas. So Utah proposed a plan. Part of that plan involved closing one of the three Rocky Mountain Power coal plants in Utah. And then they sent this plan to the EPA because the EPA has to approve the plan.
Right.
And said, you know, what do you think? And the EPA didn't really get around to that very quickly. Eventually, a local conservation group sued the EPA and said, you're past your deadline. You need to make a decision. And the EPA eventually, after a long series of public hearings and other things of that nature, decided to reject Utah's plan and install its own plan, which required the remaining two power plants to install additional pollution controls.
So essentially EPA says, Utah, your plan's not good enough. We're going to come in and make it better. Has that decision, you know, the decision by the EPA to force tighter regulations on these power plants, has that been implemented at all yet?
It is currently being litigated by Rocky Mountain Power and by the state of Utah.
Okay. What was their time frame on cleaning up the airshed around national parks from coal-fired power plant pollution?
The deadline's 2064.
2064. That is
a ways out.
A long way. I probably won't even be around at that point. Is that normal? That kind of time frame seems really long to me, just out of curiosity.
Well, I mean, because what they're trying to do is establish natural air conditions. What they've done is they've created kind of this step-down process where each the states have to come up with a new plan every roughly 10 years, I think. Maybe don't quote me exactly on the exact number. So this is the first round of plans. We're actually coming up to where the next round of plans is going to be due. So Utah's first plan is probably still going to be being discussed and litigated while we work on going into our second round of planning.
So what is Senator Lee and Representative Chaffetz trying to do? They have a bill that would do away with the pollution mitigation efforts of the EPA?
Well, what would happen is they're saying that the EPA overstepped its regulatory authority when it rejected Utah's plan. So they have proposed to reject the EPA's plan and tell the EPA that they have to either readopt or reconsider Utah's plan, because what their argument is that the EPA made this decision on criteria that are not actually in the Clean Air Act. That is possibly a gray area that we're dealing with here, because again, we're dealing with a closure of a plant. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, that was the problem all along. It wasn't clear whether or not closing the power plant counted as reducing the necessary emissions, and the EPA decided it didn't, and now we have the federal government maybe stepping in and being like, maybe it did.
Okay, so so with the closure of one of the power plants, there's going to be less emissions. The EPA mm-hmm. says you actually, with this other power plant, or these two other power plants, you mm-hmm. still need to clean up your act.
Mm-hmm.
So is this bill advancing? What's happening with this bill?
It's just been introduced so far, so that's all we got at the moment.
You pointed out that Rocky Mountain Power, in your article, you said that they were kind of taken off guard with this news. As you mentioned, they have a lawsuit or there's litigation going on.
I'm
assuming that they were kind of okay with this proposal from Senator Lee and Representative Fisk.
They don't seem too upset by it.
Okay.
But, yes, they apparently were not involved in the drafting of the proposal. They found out about it after the fact, apparently in some case through Twitter.
Oh, wow. Robert Kirky, from the opinion desk, Lee and Chaffetz said essentially that this is Obama-era overreach, and mm-hmm. They're also saying that they're trying to lower people's power bills, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Deregulating industry may be kind of a trend in the Trump era now.
Yeah, it certainly fits into what we've seen with the Trump administration looking to significantly cut the funding for EPA and roll back some of these regulations, not just on air, but on water quality and other protections. And so, I think this is a trend we're going to see. I mean, it sort of takes what Reagan tried to do when he was deregulating and then, pumps it up on steroids to an even higher level. And so the proposal from Senator Lee and Representative Chaffetz sort of fits right into that mold.
Well, again, I'm still going back to this 2064 implementation. It just seems like such a long time frame. But
well, Senator Hatch will still be around to make sure it gets done. So.
All right. A quick reminder to our listeners that you can comment on the stories that we are discussing today. Call us at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. Emma Penrod, I want to stick with environmental stories and even air quality stories. The Air Quality Board, in the wake of a bill passed during the legislative session, is doing something kind of unprecedented. They are objecting to something. Tell us about this.
Well, I don't know that it's unprecedented, but it hasn't happened in at least a decade. They have asked the governor to veto a bill that they believe stymies their own ability to pass regulations that could improve Utah's air. They don't really feel like this is the greatest idea in light of our, redesignation as a serious air quality area. They would prefer to have all their options open to them rather than having to deal with this situation, which would say there are certain things that Utah can't regulate. In this case, you can't regulate wood burning if it's being used to produce food.
Okay, so this bill is about wood burning, changes the rules on wood burning during our winter inversion months. Where did this bill come from?
I don't know that it changes the current rules on wood burning during the winter months. My understanding is that the rules already grant an exception for wood burning when there's food involved.
Yeah.
My understanding is that what this bill does is it says that the Air Quality Board and the Division of Air Quality can't ever regulate wood burning if it's related to food. So it's more of this kind of forward-looking objection mm-hmm. where they're like, it's not that it's changing anything, it's that it's preventing them from doing something in the future that they might have done in light of the fact that we're going to have more air emission cuts.
This bill's sponsor, Representative Mike Schultz of Hooper, he had said that this bill essentially was brought to him by a local manufacturer of grills, of wood pellet grills. Is that right?
That is my understanding. That's what he said. I understand that the company's CEO has also confirmed that that's what happened.
Air quality groups and the Air Quality Board want to see this vetoed. Do we know if the governor might do that? I don't. Do they want to see it vetoed? Is that
the Air Quality Board would like to see it vetoed? Multiple environmental groups would like to see it vetoed. They are hoping that because the Air Quality Board involves people who are appointed by the governor, that means maybe a veto is more likely here. Maybe he'll be listening to them because these are people he's selected, people he thinks are experts in the field. So, and it's interesting that Air Quality Board is largely not staffed, I guess, by environmental groups. It's mostly actually industry representatives, and they did call for this veto unanimously.
Hmm. You know, so there's no ban on this right now. So if you want to grill in the winter, you can. If you are a wood fired pizza place, you can still make your pizzas during the winter the winter months. This would just say that in the future, if we needed to adjust those, you can't enforce that.
Yep.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens there. Another environment story, and this is one that you wrote just yesterday. Utah Rivers Council, a conservation group or an environment group, was looking for information on water use in the state. But they were having some difficulties because the state didn't want to share this information, and so they appealed to the State Records Committee. Tell us the story, Emma.
Yeah, so this group, they're very interested in water use trends and, whether we need to be developing new water resources or whether we should focus on conservation. And over the course of the years, they've been collecting various records on water use. You know, they would, request to a certain city, can we see, your totals, how much water has been used in your city, and they'd get these records. Recently, they started looking at some information that the state provides on municipal water use and discovered that there were some fairly significant discrepancies between what was being reported to them by the cities and what was being presented by the state.
What did those discrepancies look like?
In some cases, especially it seemed small communities in Washington County would report to the Rivers Council that they had used, say in the range of 50 acre feet of water a year, and then they would, the state would say that they had used, something in the range of several hundred acre feet in the course of a year, and so the Rivers Council just wanted some information on why these differences were occurring. These numbers are reported by the municipalities to the state, so they didn't know if the municipalities are giving different numbers to different people, or are these numbers in some way being changed by the state. They say that they understand there's a process where the state goes through and maybe runs some mathematical calculations to try to fix what they perceive to be inaccurate estimates from various municipalities. So they then grammared and sought the internal database at the Division of Water Resources to understand why the numbers were different.
Why would and they were granted this request was granted, correct?
The request for that database was denied.
Oh, it was denied. Okay.
That's why they went to the State Records Committee.
Sorry. Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. But why would the state? Maybe this is you say that there are calculations going on. I think that the Utah Rivers Council, I've seen press releases saying that that they see something more nefarious going on. But why, if you go with that narrative, why would the state want to be inflating the numbers on how much water is being used?
Well, the Utah Rivers Council accuses the state of artificially inflating the numbers in order to further its goals of driving large water projects. I personally don't read the state's mind, so I don't know if they're doing that
or
why they would be doing it.
Okay. What information? So, as you said, they appealed this to the State Records Board. They wanted to get this information, and the outcome is yes, they're going to be able to access this information. Is that correct? Or a draft report?
So what happened was they go to the State Records Committee, and the state argues that they can't deliver this information because it's being used to develop a state or a draft report to the legislature. And because drafts are protected, they're not required to be disclosed. They said, well, we can't also disclose this data because it's part of this draft. The Records Committee didn't really particularly like that argument. They felt like if the numbers themselves and the calculations themselves were finalized, that those numbers could be released, and they therefore ruled that the database should be released.
Okay. I'm kind of curious about the reason for trying to keep this information secret, as stated by the state. Did you just address this? Like, why are they trying? Why do they say that it shouldn't?
Their argument was that it was part of a draft report that the legislature requires them to have reviewed by a third party, an independent third party, and they said that they didn't feel it was appropriate to be releasing the information until it had been verified by this third party.
Okay. Robert Gerke, any comments on transparency in government here on this story?
You know, the Utah Rivers Council has been for years trying to get data out of the state, and it seems like every time they try to do it, they get pushback from these water officials. And you know, the people of Utah own this water, and it's administered on behalf of the Utahns' interests by this board. And so the disclosure of this information seems pretty fundamental, and it just kind of boggles my mind a little bit why every time they try to get this data, they end up having to go to court or go to the records committee to get it.
You know, there are actually a couple of wins for transparency in this meeting, actually. And Dan Harry, there was a group fighting to find out Utah's deal, its tax deal with Amazon.com, and they also had their request granted from the Utah Records Committee, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. Yeah. So what the Libertas Institute was asking for was the contract that the Utah Tax Commission signed with Amazon back in December, and they began collecting sales tax on your online purchases if you live in Utah January 1st. You know, this is expected to mean tens of millions, if not more, of dollars of revenue to the state, but the state tax commission wouldn't release any details about that. They said that was proprietary, they would be violating trade secrets and unfair competition rules that protecting Amazon. And so they denied the request. Again, the records committee said, no, that's not a good argument. You know, you've got to release this material. They said you could redact some proprietary information, but the basic contract itself should be disclosed. Hmm. Now, the tax commission left its option open to go to court to challenge that. I don't know if that's the same case with the water database, they still do have an opportunity to contest this by going to court if they want to.
So. Emma Penrod is nodding on that. The same thing is the case with the water story. What will be learned from this Amazon.com deal?
We don't know.
Yeah.
You know, again, like in the water database, I think a lot of the suspicion is that the state, this is the claim, or this is the suspicion, that the state is inflating these water use numbers to better have a basis of support for big, expensive projects like Lake Powell Pipeline, like Bear River water dams. That's the suspicion. In the case of Amazon, the suspicion is, why is this giant retailer voluntarily now all of a sudden deciding to collect tax for the state of Utah?
The question
is, are they getting something that's out of sight, that's hidden from sight? Hmm. The only thing that the tax commission has allowed that Amazon is getting is a 1.31% basically holding fee like other retailers get for collecting this tax.
You would think that Amazon, if, say, they are the only major online retailer that is collecting tax, would kind of not want to have that be publicly aired too much, because would that drive competition in a different direction? If everybody's supposed to be reporting their taxes that they are and paying the taxes that they buy when they make online purchases.
They're supposed to be. No one does. I mean, very few people do.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think, if I could, one of the other things that I think would be revealed by this Amazon, or could potentially be revealed if this Amazon deal becomes public, is what the actual scope of the money lost through the online sales tax is, because Amazon obviously is the largest of the online retailers.
About 21%, it's estimated, of
yeah.
the online sales.
And, you know, the governor and the legislature have said as much as $250 million a year in sales tax are not being paid because of this online sales tax. And so if we saw some of the data from the Amazon deal, that might shed some light on actually how much we're talking about that could be collected. And I think it also, you know, I think the concern from Amazon is they're going to have to go around and probably start negotiating these deals with other states. And if the terms and the state is going to have to be negotiating with other retailers. And so if the terms of that deal become public, then that they maybe lose some leverage when it comes time to start negotiating and bargaining with the other states.
With other states. Well, after the records committee said both on the water case and in the Amazon.com case, these records have to be released, assuming that, you know, they don't get challenged. When will that information be forthcoming? When will that happen?
Generally speaking, they have about 7 days to create an order that becomes official, and then I believe the agency has 30 days after that to comply with it.
Okay.
Or to appeal, yeah.
Yeah, or to appeal. Okay, well, guys, we have to take another break here on the show, and really interesting reporting. But when we come back, we will turn to the strange tale of Jeremy Johnson's night off from his 11-year prison sentence. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment.
What if, instead of browsing the World Wide Web, we were all browsing Gophernet?
Gopher is easy to navigate and easy to browse.
Because in the early 90s...
Gopher was taking off faster.
Until they made one crucial mistake.
At that point, Gopher traffic on the internet dropped off.
Find out why open source won the battle for the internet next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Join us Sunday afternoon at 2 on Utah Public Radio.
As Republicans fight amongst each other about their health care bill, is it too cruel? Is it cruel enough? The president weighed in on the process. He said, quote, "It's a big, fat, beautiful negotiation." No idea what that means, except we know the president would not date it. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the radio show where looks don't matter because you can't see us. That's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Join us Saturday morning at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Matt Piper, Emma Penrod, and Robert Gerke. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions during this Friday morning news roundup. Call us at 801-355-TALK or comment at sltrib.com. Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, Jeremy Johnson, who has been a central figure in the public corruption stories surrounding former Utah Attorneys General John Swallow and Mark Shurtleff, has been in prison serving an 11-year sentence for providing false information to a bank. He was serving that sentence in California but came to Utah for the trial now completed of John Swallow. During the trial, Johnson was sent to Salt Lake County Jail for contempt of court because he refused to testify. And then after the trial, something kind of funny happened. What was it that happened, Dan?
Right. So he was being held in the jail. He was supposed to be held there on his contempt charge, which was a very short term, and then released to the custody of federal authorities who were going to take him back to California to complete his 11-year prison sentence there. And instead, they just released him. And according to Johnson, he tried to tell them he was supposed to be released to the authority of federal officials, and they basically said, get out of here.
Yeah.
So he left. He says it was kind of getting toward evening. He said he called the, I guess, the U.S. Marshal's office or the feds in California and left a voicemail for them and said, "Hey, I'm not fleeing. They just kicked me out of jail, but I tried to surrender myself and they wouldn't let me. I'll be happy to do so in the morning." And then, you know, had a night off.
Right.
So I guess met his wife and they went to a hotel and he said watched movies. And
right. And, and his parents happened to be in town watching a jazz game as well. So he saw them and he ate at Heyer's Big H hamburgers.
Who wouldn't?
Why? Right? Yeah. Right. Was this a paperwork mix up or was he released because his time?
The sheriff's office just came out and said, yes, this was our mistake. We apologize for it. It shouldn't have happened. And they're right. It certainly shouldn't have happened. But it did. And he did surrender himself. So I guess Jeremy Johnson came out a little bit ahead on the thing.
Robert Gerke, the latent conspiracy theorist in all of us wonders just how coincidental the release was. I mean, he didn't talk at the trial. Then there's this accidental release. If this was a John Grisham novel, this may have been a reward for like not speaking or something.
I don't know if that's the case. I just think it would make a fun movie. You know, Jeremy's night out kind of type deal. It is one of those screw ups. I don't think there was anything nefarious or, you know, any gimmicks or, you know, strings pulled for him. It just sort of one of those things that happened.
It seems like such a very Utah story. And from that odd Utah story to another that people say makes Utah look odd, the proposal to lower the legal blood alcohol limit to 0.05 percent. This is something that was passed during the most recent legislative session. There's now a push to repeal it. From a couple of groups. Dan, Harry, can you talk about this? Tell us what's going on.
Right. So the 0.05 level, it would be the lowest in the country. And a lot of the critics are questioning whether it really is tied to the idea of impairment. Because the idea is you want to get impaired, you know, alcohol impaired folks off the road, right? They're dangerous. The question is a 0.05 really the level of impairment? And how quickly can a social drinker get there? Very big questions. The legislature, who controls liquor laws in the state of Utah, doesn't have much personal experience with alcohol. Estimated 90% do not drink. They're LDS, and they abstain from alcohol. And so they're passing this legislation sort of on a trust me level that, officials have some officials, safety officials, traffic safety officials have said this is a good thing. It will help, decrease DUI fatalities and accidents. So we're going to do it. Now it sits on the governor's desk, and all kinds of a lot of organized industry groups are driving the push to veto this.
Including the Salt Lake Area Restaurant Association.
Right, and they're the ones that are sponsoring a rally today at the Capitol. They claim there will be hundreds of people there. I don't know. That's supposed to happen at noon today. We'll see. And they're calling on the governor to veto this. We saw a couple of full-page ads yesterday in the Salt Lake Dailies. And they were kind of mocking the law. You know, one of them was a mock letter from Colorado thanking Utah for making sure all the tourists now are going to come to their state instead of Utah. So,
again, listeners, call us with your thoughts on this story and the others we're covering today. We're at 801-355-TALK. You can also comment at sltrib.com. What does law enforcement say about the lowering of .05?
Well, law enforcement did not support this bill. I think there's some real concern about the enforcement levels. Our investigative columnist over here, Robert Gerke, is digging into this, and we'll hear more about that coming up soon.
I will say, I talked to Representative Lee Perry, who's a Utah Highway Patrol lieutenant. I talked to him the other day about this bill because he voted for it. And I'm like, well, how are you going to enforce this? He's like, we're going to continue enforcing this the same way we've always enforced DUI. We'll, if you're driving erratically or if we're concerned about the way you're driving, we'll pull you over. If we think it's necessary, we'll administer a field sobriety test. If you fail the field sobriety test, you're getting arrested, and then we'll take your breathalyzer. Or, you know, you'll blow into the breathalyzer. And if you're, you know, and he said, really, it doesn't change. It's still a subjective judgment by the police officer as to whether you're a danger on the roads. And if they think you are, then they're going to take you in. And if they think you're not, then they'll let you go. And it doesn't really matter where your blood alcohol level is until it comes time to administer that test so they can have that as evidence in the court.
Right. So if you fail the field sobriety test, you're already showing signs of impairment.
And Lee said the way it works is that you are under arrest before they take your blood alcohol level, because if you fail the field sobriety test, they consider you impaired.
There was kind of an interesting side note to the story that Democratic State Senator Jim DeBacchus conducted his own field sobriety test on video, right?
Right.
What happened here?
Well, that was quite interesting. The way they did it, I don't think it worked out quite right, but he began with being stone cold sober. And use some
mouth. As sober as Jim ever is. Let's be honest.
That's true. There's some latent.
I'm kidding.
But he used some mouthwash. You know, swished it around in his mouth for 10 seconds or so, and spit it out, and then took the breathalyzer test, and it showed them with a 0.5 blood alcohol, which is 10 times
this
legal limit. So, you know, that raised some real questions, but it also kind of screwed up the machine that they were using.
Yeah.
So from then on, they really had a hard time getting an accurate test, so they were doing things like deducting 0.07 from the counts. So, but it did raise questions. And I think one of the important things about this law is not necessarily the enforcement of it, but it's the public attitude. It's sort of the fear of, you know, can someone have a drink or two drinks at all and be safe from getting arrested? And I think that raises a real fear of social drinkers, whether they can do that or not.
Yeah, I will just mention, when DeBacchus did his, I mean, there's something that the law enforcement calls the Baker Rule, which means you have to take 15 minutes before you administer the test because of that, because the alcohol stays in the person's mouth and will skew the breathalyzer results. But I think Dan's point is right on, that this is, if it's not enforceable, then we're just making a social statement. This is a message bill, pure and simple. But it's also a message bill that has some severe consequences that could have severe consequences for a lot of people, not only the people that are driving, but these restaurants that now have insurance liability that they're going to have to deal with, the drivers who are going to have insurance liability that they're going to have to, that they may have to deal with if they get stopped and do blow a 0.05. And, you know, and we have this issue with the tourism, which I think is real. I mean, I think that not only are the restaurants concerned about it, but yeah, the hoteliers and the convention business is going to be hurt by this as well. So, you know, the governor, I think it's going to be very difficult for him to veto this just because he doesn't want to appear like he's being weak on DUI. He doesn't want to be advocating for, you know, drunken driving. But at the same time, I think there are some serious questions about the practical implications of this.
Right. And, you know, one of the interesting things about this whole debate was that the Utah legislators kept saying, Europe does this. It works great. It's the only time I've ever heard the Utah legislature encourage Utah to adopt European-style laws. It really is. It was a strange
thing. But in Europe, they do a lot more checkpoints, and so they don't have these things called civil liberties where you can actually, they can stop you for any reason and make you take a breathalyzer test. And in this country, we don't. That's not how we enforce these DUI laws here.
All right. Well, we'll see if the governor decides to veto this or not. Any predictions, Robert Gertz?
Yeah, he's going to sign it.
Okay. Well, guys, we are out of time for our general regular stories this week, but we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. Maybe some that we haven't covered on the show today or that caught your attention, and I'll stick with you, Robert Gerke. Any underplayed stories of the week?
Yeah, I mean, there was a story that Tommy Burr and Courtney Tanner did that was in today's paper. It's a rundown of the Trump budget and its impacts on Utah, and I think typically these budget stories, I've worked in D.C. for a number of years, and these budget stories are kind of a waste of time usually because the Congress doesn't care what the budget is. But I think in this one, since it's the first budget from the Trump administration, it says a lot about the priorities of the Trump administration and sort of its vision for the government. And they do a nice rundown of how this potentially could affect Utah if these cuts are implemented.
Okay. Story in the Tribune on Trump's budget from Robert Gerke. Emma Penrod, your underplayed story of the week.
So I guess sticking with my theme today of environmental or, you know, outdoors kind of related stories, I'm going to go with the story about a wildlife official who was accidentally shot by a tranquilizer that had been intended for a bear and ended up in the hospital, but ended up being okay. I guess he shot himself in the hand because his gun malfunctioned.
Wow.
But fortunately, the mix of tranquilizers they were using isn't one that's harmful or as harmful to humans, and so, you know, scary incident, but it sounds like everyone's
was he over 0.05
okay.
Right. After I was he okay to drive, I guess.
Probably not.
Well, you would think a dose big enough to take down a bear, you know, would, but
well,
anyway,
there are tranquilizers if a large enough dose to take down an animal will kill a human.
Yeah.
So
wow. Okay, Dan Harry, your underplayed story of the
week.
I'm
going to go to that budget well too and point out just one item in there which we don't know a lot about yet, but it provides for calls for funding for relicensing Yucca Mountain as the nation's high-level nuclear waste repository. And, of course, this has been a huge issue for years.
Senator Harry Reid objected to it.
Senator Harry Reid blocked that thing, and everybody thought it was dead, but now it looks like it's coming back to life.
Okay. One part of the budget there for Dan Harry's underplayed story of the week. Matt Piper, your underplayed story.
Yeah, sports reporter Chris Kimrani did a really nice piece, I thought, on ESPN analyst Holly Rowe, who is a University of Utah alum, and she is battling cancer and working pretty unbelievable hours. If you get the chance to check that out, make note of the story of her trying to get to Utah to cover the Red Rocks, her first opportunity, I think, since going national to cover a Salt Lake City event. It's pretty cool.
Okay. For mine, I'm going to go with a Paul Raleigh column. It's St. Patrick's Day today, and ever since I was a kid, I've been marching with my Irish-American family in the parade here, which takes place tomorrow. During all of those years, I remember McNamara's band, this ragtag group of rabble-rousers who had these outrageous floats, and they poked fun at Utah liquor laws, politicians. They were always on point. Anyway, last year was their first year that they didn't participate. They won't be there again this year, and I'm just going to throw a complaint out there into the ether. Bring back Max Band. That's my underplayed story of the week. Robert Gerke, Emma Penrod, Dan Harry, and Matt Piper, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us on Behind the Headlines today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's.
We're going to wrap up today with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby says that presidential politics is not grounds for divorce.
Robert Kirby, in a recent column, you wrote about all the reasons people might get divorced and about the things that might have been deal breakers for other people, but that weren't for you and your wife. I think you are bringing home a live rattlesnake was among the things on that
list.
It
was not appreciated, that's right. She was pretty upset.
Came close to crossing the line, but it didn't do it in the end. In this column, you talked about something that did cross a line for one couple, and that something was Donald Trump.
Being the president, yeah, the fact that her husband had voted for Donald Trump and supported him prior really offended this woman, who suddenly realized that he wasn't the man that she thought he was when she married him, and she wasn't the woman she thought she was now.
This is a woman in California, and you said that something as insignificant as a president, though, really shouldn't get in the way of marriage.
Really, why would you get divorced over a president when there's so many other better reasons?
Maybe this was actually the final straw, though, between this couple. Like, maybe it's
there's every indication that they probably didn't have the greatest relationship to begin with, and this was just the final blow or straw that broke the camel's back.
This is kind of symptomatic of something that's happening around the country, not just between husbands and wives, but, you know, between groups on social media, families at Thanksgiving or Easter or whatever. It seems like we are a divided country right now.
Oh, very much so. And, I mean, I've never seen it like this in my lifetime. I think the last time we had a president that caused this much rancor in the country was Abraham Lincoln. I'm not saying that Donald Trump is an Abraham Lincoln, okay, so don't call in and threaten my life. I'm just saying that politics have always been nasty, and it's interesting how they play out over the long run.
Well, it wasn't exactly a time of unity for the country either.
No, it wasn't, and a lot of America hated him. A lot of America wanted him dead, and now he's known as the Great Emancipator, and he's on the $5 bill.
How about between you and your wife? Any major political differences in this divided country of ours?
My wife is much more conservative than I am. For Utah, I'm definitely a liberal, and we have interesting conversations over that sort of thing, but never to the point of argument. I know that politics are very important for some people, and they probably ought to be for me, too, but they're not.
How about advice for people who are having those kinds of challenges in their relationships based on politics?
Well, far be it from me to give anybody marital advice, but I would say you'd have to take a real hard look at your relationship and find out whether love trumps whatever problem you have.
All right. Can we expect an advice column from you any days?
Kidding.
That's Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of his opinions at sltrib.com. That does it for this edition of the show. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio, also to to KCPW's Emily Means. Thanks to you for tuning in as well. You can find podcasts of the show at our website, kcpw.org, or through whatever service you use to get podcasts on your smartphone or device. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you again next Friday.
This Week in This American Life. Teenage girls of America have questions about love, and there is a place where they turn to grown-ups for advice. Famous grown-ups.
I just figured out how to use the effects button, so I'm going to have this whole video in the mirror effect. I got two heads.
Just what happens when you ask a grown-up this week.
Join us Saturday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan. Also heard online at upr.org.